Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
You know, we have to stay woke. Like, everybody needs to be woke.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network. Lars and Niles.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host, Lars Larson.
To be blunt, this is a bad plan intended to execute a flawed strategy built on incorrect assumptions, and you, as the school board directors, are the only people with the power to stop it.
That is a parent talking to the Seattle Public Schools, but this could be happening and is happening in most parts of the Pacific Northwest. School districts are deciding to try to mollify parents and people in neighborhoods by keeping empty buildings open when the public schools are in money trouble because they've promised too much money to their employees. They've granted raises they could not afford, and now they say we ought to close down some of these empty buildings. And believe me, they are empty, and I'll describe the particulars of that. Now, I'm going to ask you this in the X poll today. Should school districts, not just Seattle, but every district in the Pacific Northwest, should school districts close empty buildings or keep them open just to make the neighborhoods happy? Now, I understand that every time a school district says, we need to save some money, and so we've got all these buildings, they're not nearly full at all. We don't expect them to be full anytime soon. So we're going to maintain all of this empty space and then at the same time tell the taxpayers, who are most of the population, a smaller percentage are parents and or students, but the bulk of the population are the people who pay for the public schools. We're going to say to them, we've decided to keep a bunch of empty buildings open because anytime we talk about closing even one of them, and Seattle is going to do a lot more than that. We get all this grief from neighborhoods. And they say, don't close our neighborhood school. Effectively, close down somebody else's neighborhood school. So the Seattle Public Schools, and shame on the school board for doing this, they came up with a plan. And they said, we are going to close 21 schools. Now, that should give you some idea, but I'll be more specific in a moment. That should give you some idea of how much empty space they have. Now, if you can close 21 schools and still have more than enough room for all the students in the school district, they are looking at saving $31 million a year just by that one move. Now, what could you spend that money on? Books, computers, teacher salaries, other things that are needed for education. So if you have that choice, we can have empty buildings open, and or we could close them and take the resources that we're spending on the empty buildings and spend them on actually educating the kids, which, by the way, I know it's a tired subject, but the public schools in the Pacific Northwest do a downright pathetic job of educating your children. And even if you don't have kids in the schools, you're paying for the schools with your taxes. So imagine an operation, and there are plenty of them in the last few years since the pandemic and a lot of remote work, where companies have said, even the radio station that is our flagship radio station, that's KXL in Portland, has said, we don't need all this empty space. They were at an entire floor and a half of a building. They are now at one half of a floor of a building. And why? Because they don't need the space, and paying for empty space does not accomplish the task that you have set out to do, whether it's radio or education. In this case, the public, meaning mostly parents and people who live in those neighborhoods, have said, how dare you talk about closing down our neighborhood school? Why, that's going to affect our property values. Why, my little Johnny or Susie doesn't want to go to another school that's still empty to a large degree. But before I get into the details on that, I want to offer you the chance to vote in our X poll. And it's a fairly simple choice. Should school districts close down empty buildings or keep them open just to make the neighborhoods happy? I would say close the empty buildings and put those resources to work actually educating the kids. Today's X-Bull is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, that's what we provide right here every day on the Radio Northwest Network. And it's easy. 866-HEY-LARS. And if you happen to be a naysayer, I imagine I may get some parents who say, oh, no, I want empty buildings. I don't have to worry about my kids getting educated. I want empty buildings because that empty school building in my neighborhood makes it easier to sell my house, makes my neighborhood more attractive. Why, it gives me a place to walk my dog or go for a walk. Great. Good for you. Are you willing to pay the tab? Are you willing to let kids be shortchanged in education so you can have empty buildings in your neighborhood? That's what it boils down to. Glad to have you with me and glad to take your calls at 866-439-5277. As always, naysayers go to the head of the line. And of course, you can send emails to talk@LarisLarsen.com. But I thought Como News did a fairly good job of describing exactly where the numbers are. We're talking about a school district where fully one third of the buildings are empty. They don't have kids or teachers in them. They are just sitting empty, and that means extra cost. Listen to this.
We are looking at the schools that are very small as potential for being consolidated into other schools.
According to the district, elementary schools are only at 65% capacity, and this new plan would increase school utilization to 85%.
Yeah, that's all it's going to do. You're still going to have buildings that have lots of room in them, 15% empty space, but instead of 35% empty space, the savings calculated at about $25.5 to $31 million. Now, Seattle Public Schools chickened out. They rolled out the proposal, two of them, one of them announced this month, that would close down 21 schools and end all of the K-8 and option elementary schools. The second plan that would only save $25 million would close 17 schools and keep an option K-8 school open in each administrative region. So I think it's pretty simple what they're talking about. Should we save all that empty space and leave it unused at the taxpayers' expense and not spend those resources on educating our kids, or should we close down the empty buildings? And frankly, the fact that the school board rolled this idea out, said we're going to have public hearings on it, and now, well, the superintendent, Brent Jones, who I know makes a six-figure salary, I would guess probably $250,000 to $300,000 a year to make the tough decisions. And what did he do? It sounds like he chickened out. He said he is pausing to reconsider the recommendations. The closures were set to take effect next year. Now they're going to be pushed off into the future. So it seems that Brent Jones is not exactly earning his superintendent's salary. When you advance a proposal and say this is what we need to do to provide quality education, not just for parents, not just for kids, but for every single taxpayer who pays for those schools. And then once you roll the proposal out and you get a few angry parents saying, no, you can't close that school in our neighborhood, you chicken out? Is that how you're earning your six-figure salary, Superintendent Jones? Because it seems kind of cowardly to me. If you think this is the best prescription for the kids, and now you say, well, let's just put the decision off. After all we're wasting at this point is the taxpayers' money. All that we're foregoing is the quality education of your kids. And in the meantime, the Seattle Public Schools, and they're not the only one. Portland has this problem. Eugene has this problem. Other school districts around the Northwest have the same problem. They'll say, we'll just keep on wasting the taxpayers' money. And by the way, no, your kids are not getting educated. Back in a moment with the Northwest Nonsense. If you want to join, it's 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larsen Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Know your risk.
When he talks, you have no choice but to listen. More with Lars.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say. sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
It is true that state bureaucrats in Salem and Olympia demonstrate their incompetence on a regular basis, but they surely know how to spin a bad news story. Example, unfortunately, the level of journalism in the Pacific Northwest has declined to where too many reporters, best case, rewrite government press releases, worst case, don't even bother with the rewrite, but just reprint it. As crazy as it sounds, Oregon made it legal for illegal aliens to get driver's licenses over the direct opposition of two-thirds of the voters in the state. Then it made voter registration automatic for everybody with a driver's license. At the time, they proposed that many of us question, how will you keep the illegal aliens who now have driver's licenses from ending up registered to vote? State officials falsely claimed, we have measures in place to make that impossible. Well, ironically enough, it was a liberal conservative think tank in Chicago, not a conservative one, a liberal Chicago think tank, that started asking questions about Oregon's voter registration scheme that the Salem bureaucrats never even bothered to ask. Boom! 1,259 illegally registered voters. Some may be green card holders, but none of them have citizenship that is required to vote. At least nine of them have already voted in past elections. Until last week, all 1,259 illegal voters were slated to receive ballots in the election coming up November 5th, which means those ballots would go out just over 2 weeks from now. So, did the DMV use the big number in its press release to newsrooms yesterday, or the tiny number? Well, here's the state headline. DMV error led to 9 ineligible voters. If all you do is read the headline, you're going to say 9, not that big a deal. COIN, KGW, and KPTV took the bait off that press release and ran headlines featuring 9 ineligible voters instead of 1,259. My flagship radio station, KXL, ran an honest version of the story, I'm proud to say. At least ABC affiliate K2 resisted the press release version of the story. K2 wrote this headline, Oregon DMV error mistakenly registered 1,200 possible non-citizens, state reveals. Even the Daily Dead fish wrapper Oregon Live didn't fall for it. Oregon DMV registered 1,200 non-citizens to vote. Now, do we know if there are any more non-citizens on the rolls who get ballots in a couple of weeks? No, we do not. And don't count on the Democrat-dominated government in Salem to even bother looking for them. Our question of the day, and this one comes in from Aaron Landrini. He says, was the registration of illegal voters by Oregon DMV just a failed Democrat tactic to cheat in elections? I would say yes to that. He says, Oregon DMV is calling these illegal aliens being registered to vote a clerical error. I'm calling it a failed political tactic because they got caught. I believe we would have never heard about this if they had gotten away with it. If the state would stop giving driver's licenses to people who break the law to get here, there would be no possibility of them being accidentally registered to vote. If they're not willing to go through the proper channels to become a citizen, they should not qualify for privileges like driving, welfare, and housing. Thanks for what you do. Keep up the good work. Signed, Aaron. Our second question, are Boeing workers reaping the whirlwind of their politicians that their union supports? They wouldn't be demanding a 40% raise right now if Joe Biden hadn't totaled the American economy. The note comes in from Mike Buck. Lars, I bet you dollars to donuts, 90% or more of those Boeing machinists voted for Biden and will vote for Harris and Ferguson. I don't feel sorry for them at all. I hope their strike drags on and Boeing moves commercial airplanes out of Washington State. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
Well, I gotta give the Daily Grill to this, Marie Glusenkamp Perez, or Marie Perez, if you're using the name honestly. She's a member of Congress right now. She's the same woman who literally said, nobody stays awake at night worrying about illegal aliens coming across the border. Let me point something out to you. The sanctuary laws of Washington State I believe, played a role in the death of a Washington State trooper. The Washington State Patrol on Friday, the 27th, is going to conduct a one more stop patrol in honor of fallen trooper Chris Gadd on Friday, September 27th. And just remember that when you think about who to vote for a member of Congress, Marie Gluzenkamp-Perez, who dismisses the very idea. Why is anybody worried about illegal aliens? Well, I'll bet Trooper Gadd's family could tell you. And then this, the best email of the day so far, but you can send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Nick writes in, Lars, hell of a day to be a member of Hezbollah, a terrorist group, huh? First the pagers, then the walkie-talkies, and that's what should be on the minds of every group of this terrorist organization, and have them as nervous as a wiener dog after 12 cups of coffee. They have just successfully figured out how to tell who are the Hezbollah terrorists and mark them with a permanent limp, a mangled hand, a disfigured face, or just plain killed them. It's always sad when a child is lost as a result, but it's a dangerous line of work being part of a terrorist group for both you and your loved ones. Whomever is responsible for this, brilliant. Signed, Nick. Now let's go to our first naysayer of the day. David, what do you and I disagree about since we're short of time that makes you a naysayer?
Okay, proposition for the schools, I think they should keep the buildings open, run all the illegal aliens into those for housing, and build a federal government. What do you think about that?
I think, number one, the federal government would not give us the money, and the federal government's money is the same money as your state government money, David. In case you haven't noticed, the taxes you pay go to Roseburg, where you live. They go to Douglas County. They go to the state of Oregon, and they go to the federal government. No matter which government is paying for it, you're paying for it. And why should we give the illegal aliens anything? All it does is encourage more to come, doesn't it?
I'm sure it does, Lars. Yeah, hey, I love your show, and I'm just kind of like pulling your leg. So
I kind of got that. David, thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Richard. Hey, Richard, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Well, I had about four issues. I want to know where all the carbon tax money's going, all the money from the marijuana tax, and I see that Oregon, their Kaiser, had a $71 million shortfall in their schools. They've sucked in a ton of money on the marijuana tax and other taxes. And then we've got people that own property that pay taxes. And then we got hundreds of people living in apartment houses that don't pay any taxes and vote on property rights.
I hate to disappoint you on the pot tax, but the latest numbers I've got, state of Oregon is going to get about $170 million from marijuana taxes. And you say, well, that's a lot of money. Well, the state spends, I think, about $5 billion. It might be $9 billion. I think it's $5 billion a year or $9 billion or $10 billion a biennium. So getting another $170 million, it's certainly a substantial sum of money, but it's a drop in the bucket when it comes to the state school support, either Oregon or Washington. I mean, everybody always thinks that the lottery or the marijuana tax or something else is the magic button and you'll make so much money from it, nobody will have to pay for schools again. The numbers just aren't there. But Richard, I appreciate the call. Coming up in just a moment, we got things to talk about on the Radio Northwest Network. Should a professional child advocate be fired if he won't endorse the right transgender pronouns? We'll let you know.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland. The Zoom meeting you actually want to be at. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. We endeavor to serve the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. And if you listen to the show, you probably know I don't have much use for all this woke nonsense about DEI, CRT, transgender pronouns, and medical mutilation of children. So with that in mind, and knowing that I don't like that stuff, I want to talk to Chris Zook, who is, or was, until recently, a CASA, which is called a court-appointed special advocate. I'm going to get Chris to describe that better because she'll do a better job than I would. But it has to do with advocating for kids when they're in a courtroom situation. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hey, Lars. Thanks for having me.
So you wrote to me and you said you are being forced to resign after 7 years of serving as a CASA, C-A-S-A. Describe for my audience what a CASA is so I don't mangle it up.
Okay. So a CASA DACA is assigned to a specific child that's in DHS custody, and our job is to go visit them once a month in their foster home. We kind of represent them in court.
Right.
We're a party to the case. Our job is to kind of get all the pieces, the attorney's perspective, the caseworker, the child, foster parent, birth parent, and give the judge a recommendation of what is ultimately best for that kid.
Just so that people know, many of these kids have been the subject of abuse. They may have been in a child custody situation where parents are fighting over the kid. Those are the kinds of kids that end up needing a CASA, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, and you go, you know, the court can turn to you because if they talk to mom's attorney or dad's attorney or the attorney for, you know, maybe the state that's bringing charges against a parent for abuse, or they're bringing charges, or the other person would be the defense attorney. This, you are the person who is there to represent the interests of the child and be able to tell the court information it needs to know to make the right decision for the kid.
Right? Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Why are you being... I'm sorry. Go ahead, ma'am.
Oh, I was just going to say, I was surprised to find out how much the judges actually listen to the CASAs. I figured they would listen to the attorneys more, but they don't. They actually want to know what the CASAs have to say.
Our position
is volunteer, by the way.
It's a volunteer position, so you're giving this out of the goodness of your heart?
Yep.
Now, tell me why and how they came to you and said, Chris, you're going to have to resign.
Well, they put out a new policy that they said they were updating all of their current policies and procedures, and we needed to sign a statement of affirmation on transgender, LGBTQ, gender-affirming behavior towards the kids. We had to agree to apologize if we accidentally called them by the wrong pronoun. We have to get on other adults if we hear them using the wrong pronoun. And basically, I had to sign that I would agree to always affirm my kids' gender identity, whatever they happen to choose.
And in fact, were you also expected, if you heard another adult, say, refer to a boy who says he identifies as a girl as a boy, that you were to report those people to the court? Is that right?
Well, or at least speak up and confront them about it and set them straight.
And set them straight on the pronoun they're calling a male child who identifies as a female but is biologically male. And I would imagine that, is it fair to say that, never having been a CASA and I'm not an attorney and haven't been through the child custody or any of that, where you place these kids may have a lot to do with who and what they are, correct?
Yes. Yeah, they're pretty, like, what my director kept saying is that transgender and LGBTQ youth are overrepresented in foster care. So we need to be, like, encouraging that, which I explained to them. I'm like, I cannot. Like, that's not good for kids. That's harmful, and I won't sign on to it.
Well, in fact, let me ask you, so I guess people can use their imagination, but when I first got your note, I thought, oh, so if Chris is advocating for a boy who identifies as a girl, and the court says, what kind of, should they, this boy, biological boy, who identifies as a girl, be placed in this household with two other girls as his sisters? The gender probably would play a role in what's best for that kid, or not best for that kid. Am I right?
Yeah, I would think so, yeah.
Because the girls in that household would be told, you are to treat him like your new sister. And in any case, you didn't want to sign it. Yep. Would you mind? I don't want to put words in your mouth. Why did you say, I can't sign that?
Because when I look at what is being done to children in our culture and the way that the adults in the room are lying to them and telling them that if they decide to be a boy, they can be a boy. It's a lie. It is. I don't know if you're familiar with the old story of the emperor's new clothes.
I am.
That's what it just came to. I mean, that to me, that was like the best analogy was the emperor's naked. This is not true. And we're telling kids that this is true and this is always true. And we always affirm it. We don't question it. And gender dysphoria has always, even currently, I believe, in the DSM-5, is a mental illness. And all of a sudden, it became the most celebrated choice that a kid could make. And we're really manipulating kids into making that choice just for the affirmation.
And I agree with you. And Chris, I'm also aware the newest research out there says most of the kids, for lack of a better term, grow out of it. That is, if you don't act on it, they at some point say, yeah, I thought I was a girl for a while, but I'm back to being a boy. Except unless, of course, they've fed you full of hormones and done a little snip, snip here and there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't go back from it. So the fact that you can't get a tattoo till you're 18 because you're not capable of making a good decision, but you're allowed to do or accept all of these things to be done to you as a developing adolescent, so wrong.
It's absolutely. Yeah, let me ask you one so other wrong. Thing, because I have religious beliefs as well. You felt this was Yamhill County telling you you need to abandon your religious beliefs. Am I overstating that?
No, because in order to do this job, I was being forced to violate something that I believe, according to my faith, is wrong. And to keep my job, I would have had to sign and agree to support that.
Do you know whether there are other CASAs who've been put in the same situation as you and have also made the decision to walk away?
I don't. I haven't heard of any, but we don't have a ton of contact with each other, so I don't really know the other CASAs personally, so there may have been, but I don't know of them.
I want to applaud you for doing this because it takes a certain amount of courage, and especially to do something you're doing out of a labor of love, 7 years of it, and then you're told, throw your religious beliefs away, disserve the kids, perhaps even put the kids in peril, medical peril, and you're saying, mm-hmm. I won't be part of that. Chris Zook, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You bet. That's Chris Zook. Now, tell me this. Have you heard of other CASAs? And how would you like to have a CASA representing a child in your community? And the CASA said, yep, I'll throw out my beliefs, I'll throw out logic and everything else, and I'll just do what woke tells me to do. I don't think that's much of a CASA.
Broadcasting from his socially distanced bunker to yours, it's Sanitized Entertainment. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. This segment of the show brought to you by 540training.com, concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense online at 540training.com. Now, our X poll today, should school districts close empty buildings or keep them open just to make the neighborhoods happy? Seattle is up against that now. They have or had proposed 21 school closings because apparently the buildings are about 65% full. This change would take them to 85%, still leave them lots of extra space. But they got a bunch of blowback from parents and people in the neighborhood who said, no, how dare you close the schools? Keep those empty buildings and don't worry about wasting the resources that you could be using to educate our kids. Today's X-Poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's go to Craig. Hey, Craig, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, great to talk to you. Tried to call you a few times. Good to talk to you. I have not a problem, but I heard one of the parts of your deal was that they want to consolidate all K K through eight schools.
No, that's not what they said. They want to close a bunch of elementary schools. There are some K-8 option schools, so that instead of going elementary and then middle school, there's a K-8 option school. They would close those. Total closures would take them from 65% of capacity, so 35% empty, to 85%. What was the point you wanted to make?
The point I wanted to make was I'm in Southwest Washington, near north of you. We fought many battles. There is still a K-8 school here, probably one of the best there was. I spent 9 years as chairman of the school board, and to me, the smaller schools are better. Don't close them.
Hold on, Craig. Okay, let's go with your plan. Most of the schools they have slated for closure, in this case in Seattle, I think every district in the Northwest should close down unnecessary schools unless they can say we're going to see a population surge in that area. So you're willing to trade having a whole bunch of empty space, all of which costs money. I hadn't finished the question, but go ahead and answer the question you thought I was going to ask.
I mean to interrupt you. I'm not a naysayer. Go ahead.
No, but you want to have empty space that costs money rather than have the resources to actually pay to educate the kids. Why is that?
No, I don't want empty space. I want you to give those resources to the smaller schools that can educate the kids.
Well, I'll tell you what, Craig. Big or small, do you think Washington schools are doing even an adequate job of education right now?
A couple of them. Not many.
I don't know that you know the numbers for those schools, but statewide, 50% of the kids are not even in adequate math, reading, or writing, or science as of eighth grade. So that's a pretty big failure rate. How much less is the failure rate in these schools you think are working well?
The failure rate in those schools I think are working well are probably 10%.
Probably. Okay, I'd love to see the numbers because I haven't seen that anywhere in the Northwest. Let's go to Alice in Ferndale, Washington, home of the only refineries in the Northwest. Alice, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Well, I'm calling in about the CASA that's being required to confront and correct people on what they have said and and putting them straight. I said that's much like being asked if you are registered to vote in an inappropriate situation. I can see expletives fly and hand gestures being made. You know, they're putting a woman who is volunteering her time in a very dangerous situation, I think.
And even if not dangerous, talk about it. If her job is to advocate for this child, and then someone, a sheriff's deputy, a judge, a court staffer, calls this biological boy who thinks he's a girl by a male pronoun, will you ask him to come sit in this chair? And she's supposed to read the Riot Act to the staff members who are also trying to do right by the kid. I'm with you. It creates an impossible situation and expends a lot of effort to accommodate pronouns when the concern should be, let's make sure this kid ends up someplace good.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yes. Thank you.
You betcha. Alice, very nicely said. Let's go to John. Hey, John in North Bend, what's on your mind?
Well, I was wondering about the words that you used to describe the economic threat we have with the Democrats, and they always use the word threat. And when they say, oh, they're a threat to society, a threat to democracy, why don't we use that word threat? That they're a threat to our economy, and they're a threat to your personal economy, and they're a threat, why don't we use that term? They use it. Well, why don't we borrow from them? They borrow the thing from us.
My first inclination is say it's kind of a cheap word because they're always saying, you know, the climate's a threat and this is a threat and driving cars a threat. They describe everything as a threat. I mean, when they act stupidly like that, the last thing I'm inclined to do is say, oh, well, why don't we act stupidly too? Because I don't know what it accomplishes. If instead we just say their plan for the United States is not good for the United States, I don't have to describe it as an existential threat, do I? I mean, there are lots of things that the government does that are bad for the people, but they aren't necessarily going to destroy the country, but they're bad for the people. I think bad for the people is good enough. if the United States government or state governments are not acting in the best interests of the people, that's plenty. Even if they're not about to destroy the country, although I think Joe Biden has done his best to try to destroy the country. It's Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
You know, we have to stay woke. Like, everybody needs to be woke.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars
and Niles.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host, Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network, and it's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. But first, I want to introduce you to the Attorney General from the great state of Idaho, who's going to tell us why he's going after a major medical group for its advocacy for mutilating and experimenting on kids. Attorney General Raul Labrador joins me now. Mr. Attorney General, welcome to the program.
It's great to be on your show. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad to do it because you seem to come up with some of the more common sense things that I don't see as much from, say, the AGs of other states. But tell me what you have joined in with the state of Idaho and 20 other states, and what you're doing with the AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics. What do you want them to do?
Well, what I want them to do is to respond to some questions that we have asked. So we wrote a letter here in the state of Idaho, and we were joined by 20 other states that puts the American Academy of Pediatrics on notice for possible violations of state consumer protection statutes. And the main issue that we're concerned about is that the AAP claims that the use of puberty blockers on children is safe and reversible. And this assertion is just not grounded in evidence. It's not grounded in science. They have been saying that to pediatricians for a long time. And the evidence that keeps coming out is that most of these claims are based on political concerns, not really based on actual science.
And just to be plain about this, General Labrador, AAP is advocating for things that may include counseling and things like that, but they also include giving puberty-blocking hormone drugs to children, in some cases without the consent or advice of their parents, and also, what, perhaps even surgery on top of that?
Correct. So they continue to say that these things do not affect children. And as we have found out more and more about these children, is that many of them, if not a large number of them or a vast majority of them, end up changing their minds after a while. They want to go back to the sex that they were born in. And many of these treatments are irreversible. Obviously, any kind of medical treatment that is invasive to the body will be irreversible. But some of these puberty blockers that they claim are safe end up having just tremendous effects on them. You know, and what the data shows is that when used to suppress hormones, some of these puberty blockers can interfere with their cognitive development. It can compromise bone density. It can negatively affect metabolic health and weight. It blocks normal puberty experience and experimentation. And when puberty blockers use is followed directly by cross-sex hormone use, which is often the case, infertility and sterility is a known consequence. So we're talking about, excuse me, a big deal.
And by the way, General, those coughs sneak up on me too, but you're talking about, and we're hearing from some young men and women who are now men and women who said they were talked into this as teenagers and now they deeply regret it because of the permanent changes made to their bodies.
Yes, I've spoken to several women who were experimented with, and they have now gone back to their birth sex, and they say that people took advantage of them, that the medical community did not explain to them fully what was happening, that when they went online, and this is the worst and most pernicious thing that you can hear about, is when they go online and they start talking about how they're suffering from, you know, some sort of dysphoria where they feel like their bodies are not complete, their bodies are not, they're not really happy with their bodies, which most teenage girls feel most of exactly. the time, that they get bombarded by mostly adults who start telling them that the reason they don't feel good about their bodies is because they probably suffer from gender dysphoria and that they should do something to change their body and to reflect the body that they really should be. So all these horrible things happen to them and they're highly influenced. And when they come to their senses, they realize that all these things are terrible and that they didn't want to do this. And unfortunately for some of them, they have done completely irreversible things, like, you know, irreversible sex change operations and others. But what we want to do is we want to make sure that the medical community understands that most of these issues are not based on science, that the evidence is actually out there that these are not irreversible effects that they have on the body and on the mind. And we should treat, and I want to be really clear, and I heard actually one of these young women say this, that we should treat people with gender dysphoria with love and empathy, because one of the things is that they feel that when they go to their families, if they're not feeling that love and empathy, then they go out to outside sources that will actually give them empathy, but the wrong kind of empathy, the empathy that causes them to irreversibly change their bodies and their minds. But we need to understand that they feel something that is real, that they feel something that they feel in their minds that is correct. But what we need to treat them with is love, respect, and proper counseling, is not changing their bodies. That should never happen.
I'm talking to the Attorney General of Idaho. That's Raul Labrador. So, General Labrador, this is all looking from you and 20 other states going out after the AAP. Are there things happening, because I'm aware they're happening in Oregon, Washington, but I'm not so sure about Idaho. Are there schools that are literally telling kids, hey, if you're gender confused, we'll get you the treatment? Are you aware of whether or not Idaho schools are participating in that? Or are they always informing parents when there is a problem of any kind with their kids?
So what the state of Idaho has decided to do is to make sure that any kind of advice or medical suggestions like that, they need to be done in the presence of a parent, and they cannot give. In fact, a law was passed, I believe, last session that said that any kind of treatment or medical advice needs to be done with the consent of the parent. So Idaho has been at the forefront of many of these issues. Idaho was the first state to pass this kind of legislation, and we actually passed legislation that made it illegal for children under the age of 18 to receive some of this treatment.
General Labrador, let me one last quick question because we're close to the break. Is it legal for doctors to do this kind of thing or give drugs to a child without parents' consent?
It should not be, and in some states people are getting away with it, and in Idaho we have said that it should not be legal.
General Labrador, it is always a pleasure to have you on. That is Idaho Attorney General Raul Labrador talking about the fact that his state and 20 other states are putting the American Academy of Pediatrics on notice for possible violations of consumer protection statutes by telling kids lies about puberty blockers and hormones and trans-sex chemicals, and they're experimenting on kids. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. When you find some.
Because you can't
Get enough, Lars. Podcast every show at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, I guess Joe Biden at this point appears to have given his last major speech that he will ever give to any world body. I mean, we could see maybe the Democrats will figure out a way to put him on the stage again somewhere. They certainly didn't reserve much room for him at the Democrat National Convention less than 30 days after they kicked him to the curb and unceremoniously replaced him with Kamala Harris, the only candidate for president, I think, in American history who got to that position of nomination without a single vote from a single American voter. But there was Joe Biden at the United Nations earlier today. And among other things, and I'll get to this in detail because I think this is proof positive that this guy will not give up the fraud, that he defends what happened in Afghanistan. But one of the things he said really stuck out to me. Some things are more important than just staying in power. Now, that's what Joe Biden told the United Nations. And the General Assembly, oh, they applauded and applauded and applauded. I want you to think about that for a moment. Some things are more important than staying in power. This is a guy who, as a young senator, gave several speeches in which he said it's time for the old guard to get out of the way and make way for the new. Well, that was when he was relatively new, one of the youngest U.S. senators ever put into the Senate, and after several decades in the Senate, one of the least productive senators to ever be in the United States Senate. And then he was vice president. He wasn't very productive for America, but boy, he was productive and then some for the Biden crime family. But that may be a subject for another day. But consider this. When he says some things are more important than staying in power, he's the guy that the party chose because they knew that he was old enough and feeble enough that he could be controlled from the outside, probably by Barack Hussein Obama, through former Obama staffers who ended up working for Joe Biden, so that Joe Biden only had to worry about what flavor of ice cream he was going to get every afternoon when he was done saying whatever they told him to say, signing whatever they told him to sign. And this guy says some things are more important than staying in power. Joe Biden is a perfect example of somebody who stayed way too long. And in fact, I think the question that everybody stopped asking, that we were asking before they bumped him out at the beginning of August and just said, you're done, Joe. Kamala is in. You're out. Before that, we were asking, has this guy so far lost it that he can't even serve as president of the United States anymore? Now, some of you may say, well, Lars, that's just because you have all this enmity toward Joe Biden. I don't have anything against Joe Biden. I have something against what Joe Biden has done to America. He has done a tremendous amount of destruction to this country. When he came in, inflation was low. Now it's high. When he came in, mortgage rates were low. Now they're high. When he came in, gasoline was low. Now it's high. When he came in, there were millions of available jobs. Now we're looking at an economy that appears to be teetering. And yes, was it necessary to spend some extra money during the pandemic, even if we hadn't gone through all the ridiculous shutdowns? Yes. But then Joe just kept on spending the money. We're now $35 trillion in debt and counting. We're at the point where the interest alone costs us $1 trillion a year, and we don't have the money. But let me get back to Joe's speech to the UN today. He once again defended the colossally damaging and deadly decision to withdraw from Afghanistan.
We need to end the era of war that began on 9/11. As Vice President to President Obama, he asked me to work to wind down the military operations in Iraq, and we did, painful as it was. When I came to office as president, Afghanistan had replaced Vietnam as America's longest war. I was determined to end it.
Yeah, he wants to end the era of war that began with the terrorist act of 9/11. Let's see. When Joe Biden came to office, was Russia at war with Ukraine? No, it was not, and would not have been under Donald Trump. Was the Middle East at war when Donald Trump left office? No, it was not, and it would not have been if Donald Trump had been in office and if Joe Biden hadn't been given the opportunity to feed tens of billions of dollars to Iran through relief from oil sanctions, through unfrozen assets. He funded the folks who fund the terrorism. Would we be in the same kind of position with China that we are right now, that we may end up with a war there? So Joe Biden brags about, I'm going to bring to an end the era of war that began with 9/11. No, you started a brand new era of war. We may end up in a war with Russia. We may end up in a war with China. There is a war in the Middle East. And we just announced this week we're sending more American troops to be on the ground there. All while Joe Biden and Kamala Harris run around telling everybody this is the first time in forever that we haven't had any soldiers in harm's way. I've seen plenty of Instagram posts from soldiers and service members who post videos of themselves saying, you say we're not in any dangerous place? Of course we're in dangerous places. It just seems the president, commander-in-chief, and the vice president aren't aware of it. But Joe Biden says pulling out of Afghanistan the way he did it, which was disastrous and deadly, was the right decision.
And I did. It was a hard decision, but the right decision. Four American presidents had faced that decision, but I was determined not to leave it to the fifth. It was a decision accompanied by tragedy. 13 brave Americans lost their lives, along with hundreds of Afghans in a suicide bomb. I think those lost lives, I think them every day.
Yeah, I don't think he thinks of them every day. And by the way, the Gold Star families are not happy with what Joe Biden has had to say. They said, for example, one man whose son, Kareem, was a Marine Corps Lance Corporal among those murdered by the suicide bomber at the Abbey Gate at Kabul's Hamid Karzai International Airport, said that withdrawal, as well as the loss of lives, are the main reason he is a one-term president. And another says he has no idea what he's saying at this point. These are Gold Star families who lost people because of Joe Biden's incompetence. That speech was written by one of his staff, and they're trying to cover Joe Biden for his involvement in the critical debacle of the withdrawal from Afghanistan. One man, Darren Hoover, who lost his son, Marine Staff Sergeant Taylor Hoover, in that bombing that also killed 169 Afghans, by the way, and wounded dozens of others. His saying that he thinks of our kids every day is a lie. He's never even said their names because he doesn't know their names. It was his decision to pull out of Afghanistan and do it in the manner that he did. He has blood on his hands, and we will not forget ever. Just consider that. And then I want to remind you one other thing. Biden bragged about the fact of his involvement in the raid that took Osama bin Laden. Let me remind you of what Joe Biden told President Barack Obama about whether or not he should do that raid.
I said, we owe the man a direct answer. Mr. President, my suggestion is don't go. We have to do two more things to see if he's there. He walked out and said, I'll give you my decision.
Yeah, just like a member of Barack Obama's staff once said, Gates, he said, Joe Biden has made every wrong call on any foreign policy decision, every foreign policy decision that he's ever made in his political career. And I think that was one more wrong call. And yet he gets a big standing ovation from the United Nations, a collection of thugs and dictators from around the world that certainly does not have America's best interests at heart. Glad to be with you and always glad to take your calls. And of course, after having said that, naysayers, you go right to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Coming up in just a moment, should the same government that currently fails at educating your kids decide whether or not the education materials you use in educating your kids at home are good enough? Are they in any position to comment on that? We'll talk about it coming up in just a moment, and I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Email talk@LarsLarson.com. He actually reads them. More with Lars right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. One of the most gratifying silver linings, if there is one, for the pandemic years of the last few has been one where American parents have become, I think, shockingly aware of what is happening with their kids in public schools and how bad an idea it is to send your kids to public schools. So many of them have made the decision. It requires time and effort and dedication to actually do the education of those kids at home. And in fact, I know why the education lobbies and the teachers unions don't want parents to do it, because they're going to figure out it's actually relatively easy and you can do a much better job than the public schools are doing and without all the political indoctrination. So Is the system going to strike back at that? Yeah. Should the government be deciding what qualifies as educational material for homeschooled kids? Matt Beyenberg is joining us now, who's Director of Education Policy at the Goldwater Institute. Matt, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
I guess it almost sounds ridiculous to me to have a bunch of people from the government in education who say we're doing a lousy job, and by the numbers nationwide and in particular in some states in particular, a really lousy job of educating your kids. But if you decided to do it at home, we're the ones who will decide whether or not what you're using to teach your kids is good enough. And this is coming as advice from the people who are currently failing a lot of kids. How does that make any sense at all?
Well, you're right. It's ridiculous, but it's also illegal. You know, Arizona was the first state in the country to pass a universal education savings account program to let every child in the state qualify for this program. So instead of sending their kid to a public school, they receive scholarship funding, and they can use that for private school tuition or at-home curriculum or supplementary materials, you know, books, all these things. And for years, these families have been thriving. There's over 75,000 kids now in the Arizona ESA program. And Arizona's governor, the folks on the left have been trying to destroy and dismantle this program, and they keep coming up short. And so this year, after conservative lawmakers blocked their efforts to roll back school choice and parental rights, just days later, the state attorney general, Chris Mays, comes out and makes this incredible demand and says, I have managed to torture the state law in such a way that I'm going to now declare that families in this program can literally no longer buy books for their kids through this program unless they can get a permission slip documenting why they're making that particular choice. So we have families buying things like Brown Bear, Brown Bear, and now these are being rejected because they're not meeting these demands of the state in violation of state law to document why it is they chose that particular book.
I mean, they want polar bears and grizzly bears. Are they looking for diversity? I mean, what ridiculous excuse can they use for saying that Brown Bear is not a good job to teach, not a good book to teach your kids from? I mean, do they have any logical basis for this?
Well, the state law is very clear, and it's kind of deja vu. Several years ago, there was a progressive state superintendent, and she was being very restrictive in terms of what parents were allowed to buy under this program. And so the state lawmakers stepped in at the time and said, you are not upholding the purpose of this program. Our intent is for families to buy what their kids need. They passed additional amendments and made it crystal clear. Families can buy all these supplementary materials. The State Board of Education approved it and said, yep, you can buy things like, you know, books and workbooks and flashcards, these things that are so self-evidently, obviously educational. You can buy those. And the attorney general went and looked into a different piece of statute and said, well, actually, I don't think you can buy them, and completely ignored what the legislature had done. They put in crystal clear language, yes, families can buy these. And the attorney general essentially just ignored that and said, well, actually, based on this other interpretation that I have, if you squint and you ignore the fact that it says, yes, you can buy these materials, then I think that you can't.
I mean, So they don't even, are there even any examples they could bring up where somebody says, well, I'm going to buy copies of Mad Magazine for my kids to read, or something that would, that almost any reasonable person would say that doesn't make sense? Or is this just another opportunity for them to harass the homeschool crowd?
This is entirely an opportunity to harass the homeschool community. You know, we have some of the items that were rejected, you know, were essentially diagrams of the periodic table of elements, the Constitution, United States presidents, constellations, right? These are things that no sane person in any universe would object to and say, yeah, you need to come back to me with a piece of paper explaining who gave you permission or instruction to use this material. So this isn't about, you know, the program is a very expansive program. It lets families purchase all kinds of materials. And there are cases where it's something that maybe isn't obviously educational. Those materials, the State Board of Education, everybody has said, all right, for those, you can, you know, offer your explanation for what you're doing. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about obviously basic educational materials. And the left has no discernible reason to explain why it is a family needs to be put under a microscope and told, we are, as has happened here, we are literally going to reject your request to use your scholarship funds on these books unless you can go dig up some kind of curriculum, calling for literally every single item. You know, we at Goldwater Institute have promoted for years this idea of academic transparency to say our public schools should at the very least be disclosing the materials that are used in K-12 schools. These are state-operated government institutions, and it's not unreasonable for parents to want to know what materials are you using. ESA families in Arizona in this program are already doing that, and now they're being told not only do you have to document it, you have to justify it.
I'm talking to Matt Beyenberg, who's Director of Education Policy at Goldwater Institute. So, Matt, I mean, I think you remember the case. I do. I think it was a woman in Rhode Island who actually went down to her public schools and said, I want to see the educational materials you're using. And I think it was for kindergarten. It might have been first grade. And they said, no, you have no right to see them. And if you keep asking, they literally threatened her with jail time if she kept it up. So the public schools lock the parents and general citizenry out of knowing what's taught in public schools. But then they demand the right to, you know, ride herd on what kind of educational materials parents can write. I mean, the same rules don't even apply to the public schools in this case, do they?
No, absolutely not. That's right. They are demanding a higher standard from these parents. Again, these parents are already documenting every single purchase the families in this program make. They already have to provide receipts, expense reports of saying, here's everything I bought and here's what all the dollars add up to. So they're already listing everything. You have nothing like that in the public school system when it comes to, again, saying, what materials are you actually assigning to kids? And that's a great example you brought up. That mother, Nicole Solis, we'd actually represented her at the Goldwater Institute, say, absolutely, you should be able to know what the district school in your neighborhood is going to be teaching your incoming kindergartner. And as you mentioned, that's, you know, district stonewalled it, threatened litigation in response. And so the total double standard that we see here from teachers' unions and their apologists to say, how dare you, you know, want to know what public schools are teaching, and then at the same time turn around and go after parents. It's the same way that we hear from the left, you know, if parents have concerns about, you know, sexually explicit content in a book, they're told that it's book banning. And yet they have no qualms about turning around and saying, we demand a permission slip for parents to be able to read Brown Bear, Brown Bear to their own children.
No, don't tell me this. Since it's the Attorney General, this Chris Mays, who's pushing this nonsense, how do you effectively fight back against that? And please don't tell me, wait till the next election.
So we actually filed a lawsuit. There are two moms. One is a former public school teacher herself, special education instructor with students with special needs. Another, a homeschool mother of 9 students who have been in this program for years. They were thriving. Their kids were thriving in this program until they hit these roadblocks of saying, we're going to start rejecting these books and stuff that you're purchasing. So the Goldwater Institute, we have stepped in, filed a lawsuit against the state of Arizona. The state superintendent of public instruction has even come out and said, we concede that the arguments that Goldwater is making are correct and needing a court to come in and provide clarity. Because the thing that's amazing is the state attorney general, Chris Mays, in starting this whole thing, literally threatened the state superintendent and their staff with essentially a misuse of public funds charge if they didn't immediately cease letting parents buy these books.
So in other words, the attorney general is ignoring what the letter of the law says and squinting a little bit and saying, okay, we're going to decide that this law means that. And when she's challenged, then she says, I might have to come after you, and I'll use my power as attorney general to come after you. I mean, this is just absolutely outrageous. Matt, thanks for what the Goldwater Institute does, and thanks for your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
That is Matt Beyenberg, Director of Ed Policy at Goldwater Institute. Can you imagine this? And watch for it to happen in every single state where parents are saying, the public schools are not performing. I'm taking my kids out. I'll do the job myself. And especially in those states where the state says, we're going to give you some of the public resources that would have gone to the failing public schools. We're going to put them in the hands of parents so kids can actually learn something. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
On the left coast. Get it? Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Our X poll today, inspired most recently by the Seattle Public Schools and the complete debacle they've had because the schools ran themselves into a financial ditch. They promised the teachers and their unions far more money than they knew that they had. Now, what happens anytime somebody promises to pay more money to the employees than they have? If you're a business, you very quickly go bankrupt. If you're a school district, what you say is, well, you know, we just promised more money than we have, so we got to find it somewhere. So the Seattle Public Schools actually did something sensible. They said, why don't we close a bunch of our school buildings? These are empty buildings. And you say, well, how empty are they, Lars? Well, I've got an answer for you. The Seattle Public Schools across the board are about 65% occupied. So imagine a school, Let's say you had a school that hold 500 kids, except you don't have 500 kids in it. You've got about 300 kids in it. And you say, well, all that empty space, it costs money. Costs money to maintain. It costs money to keep in good order. And you say, well, why don't we just consolidate some of those schools? So the guy who's making six figures, the superintendent of the district, who apparently is a gutless coward, comes out and says, I've got this plan. We're going to close 21 elementary schools and still have more than enough space for all the kids in the district to go to school. And the parents and the people in the neighborhood of those schools said, we don't want you to close our buildings. Leave them two-thirds filled because we'd rather waste money on empty space than spend the resources actually educating the kids, which the public schools don't do a great job of anyway by the numbers. So the question I framed for you, should school districts close empty buildings and use the resources on the kids or keep the empty buildings open just to make the neighborhood happy? You can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. And always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's go to Benjamin. Hey, Benjamin, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. I was listening to Kamala Harris give one of her word salads.
Yeah.
I tell you, what a mess. What a mess. But then I listen to Trump. Holy crap. He makes Kamala Harris sound like a brain surgeon.
Give me an
Trump
example.
He's so incoherent and rambling all over the place.
Benjamin.
What a moron.
Benjamin, can you give me an example of something Trump said in which you were confused or he was confusing in the way that he said it? Because I can give you lots of examples from Kamala Harris. Sure, go ahead.
Oh, don't worry. I got lots for you, Lars. How about when he was asked specifically how he would get consumer product prices down, and he started rambling about illegal immigration, cats and dogs in Springfield, all sorts of stuff. Never even touched upon.
Your ears must have been dated because, Benjamin, we spent a whole segment on that yesterday, and I compared what Harris said, and then I compared what Trump said. Trump said, number one, I'm going to bring energy prices down. He's done it before in his, you know, when his first term, and he can do it again. And because food, starting with one of the most essentials we've got, is food, if you bring energy prices down, food costs less. Why? Because food is essentially made from energy. The fertilizer is made from energy. It's planted using energy, usually diesel. It's harvested using energy. It's transported to processing, which also uses energy, and then finally ends up on your dinner plate as a result of energy all the way along. He also says he wants to go, he wants to use some trade tariffs and others to protect American marketplaces in a way that would help bring better deals for Americans. So he gave a concrete answer. Can you tell me what concrete answer Kamala, cackling Kamala, offered up for bringing prices down?
You got to take off your cult rose-colored glasses, Lars. Give me a
Well, it's
break.
Not a cult if I give you a specific example of what Trump said yesterday about bringing inflation down and specific measures to make it happen. He even explained, how would you bring down energy prices? Number one, the Biden administration is not pursuing nuclear, is not pursuing natural gas, is not pursuing oil, is not pursuing coal. They're only pursuing Chinese-made windmills, Chinese-made solar panels, and Chinese-made batteries. So if you start pursuing all energy, all of the above, oil prices came all the way down to about $35 a barrel under Trump. They're closer to $80 a barrel under Biden. Can you see the difference there?
Hey, Lars, who produced more oil this past calendar year than any prior year?
The United States. And you know why, Benjamin? There's a reason, but maybe you didn't take Econ 101. What happens when you own... What happens? What? Hold on. I'm going to answer your damn question. What happens when you own an oil well and it's $35 a barrel, but your production costs are close to 30? You don't pump out of that oil well. What happens when prices go to $80 a barrel and you have a well that you wouldn't even have pulled oil out of it because your production costs or transportation costs are higher, but now it's $80 a barrel? You sell every barrel you possibly can. The problem is it works until you run out. What was happening under Trump? Trump was allowing federal leases for oil drilling on federal lands, which is where most of it is found. Some is found on private lands, but the vast majority of oil and natural gas is on federal lands. So you can pump, like crazy at $80 a barrel until you run out of producing wells, which won't happen right away. It'll happen down the line. But if you don't allow that federal leasing, and Joe Biden, one of the first things he did in office was shut down federal leasing of lands, shut down pipelines, shut down every... He even declared in a State of the Union address that we would be out of using oil altogether in a decade, which, of course, is just about as insane as old Joe.
The Lars Larson.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
You know, we have to stay woke. Like, everybody needs to be woke.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network. Lars. And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host, Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network that serves the Pacific Northwest states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And we hope, I hope we provide honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. Glad to be with you and always glad to take your calls, which we'll do in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And before I bring Lieve Finna on, Lieve Finna is one of our great experts when it comes to education. She might appreciate today's X poll because we put up a brand new poll question every day, and I was inspired by the bad example set by Seattle Public Schools. They did something stupid. They budget more money than they have for raises, which is always a dumb thing to do. Usually in the private sector, when you do that, you go bankrupt. Or you go out of business. In government, you just ask for more money. Then they say something sensible, which is good. They make a dumb decision, then they make a sensible decision and say, we have a whole bunch of empty buildings. Why don't we sell those buildings, get rid of them, end that cost, and then we'll put the resources into the kids. And then a bunch of parents make a, I think, selfish decision saying, don't close the school in my neighborhood. I like it being in my neighborhood. I understand why. Keeps property values up. It's easy to walk your kids to school. It's nice to have a school in your neighborhood. Great. The problem is, are you willing to trade empty buildings in exchange for education of your kids? So I ask the question this way. Should school districts close empty buildings and use the resources on the kids or keep them open just to make the neighborhoods happy? You can find the question at Lars Larson Show. And it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program Lieve Finna from Washington Policy. Lieve, welcome back. And I'm sorry, man, I made you laugh, but there you go.
No, I mean, it is preposterous. It's preposterous to see what's happening in Seattle. The Seattle superintendent has fallen flat on his face. He's floated this idea to close 21 elementary schools, which would affect every student in the district because they would have to be moved into other schools. So other schools become more crowded. And, you know, I actually am sympathetic.
We're going
to
disagree. Are we going to disagree on this, Lieve? We haven't disagreed in decades, I think.
Let me point something out that is relevant to this.
Okay.
Okay? Charter schools in Washington State get no funding for their capital building expenses, okay?
Right.
So there are, the Seattle Public Schools has lost about between 3,000 to 4,000 students in the last 4 years. That's part of the problem they're facing because they've driven people out of the schools. And some of them have gone to local charter schools, and those charter schools don't have any buildings.
Yep.
Okay. And they're public schools. And
I agree. Lieve, decades ago, I said, why don't we have the charter schools co-located with the public schools, which I think the unions would really hate because it'd say, you mean our competition is going to be right down the hallway and a parent can say, my kid isn't learning on this end of the building. I'm taking them to the other end of the building. But I just don't even think that that's, politically possible. I don't know if you could, I mean, I think the unions would absolutely lose their minds if you did that, although it is a sensible idea.
Well, I mean, if we're talking about what's good for the children, okay, they yep. did it in New York City. The unions are strong in New York City. They allowed charter schools to co-locate
right.
with local public schools. And in fact, what happened, what you said would happen, did in fact happen in New York.
Well, in fact, there was a great story about, I think it was PS 149, they always call them PS, Public School 149, where half the building is has a charter, the other half has the conventional failing government school, and they were located in the same building having the same kids, the same population, the same neighborhood. So you couldn't say, well, the charter school's in a really nice neighborhood without crime and drug dealing. No, it's the same damn building. It's just
exactly.
one end of the building or the other, and the charter school
exactly.
outperforms the public school, and the unions lose their jobs.
Yes. And so what is bad about that picture? When what you're doing is you're giving children a better chance at a quality education. And so let's go back to Seattle Public Schools. This local superintendent has declared, as he's admitted, he's had to retreat because the public is, you know, the parents in Seattle are not going to take this lying down. And so he says, okay, I'm going to reconsider my idea to close 21 schools. But the state has failed to fully fund the schools. It's the state's fault. So now you know where he's going. Ha! This is the richest district in the state of Washington. It's $23,500 per student, and it can't manage. It spends
I want the people money to faster. Focus on that number Leave just mentioned.
Yes.
$23,000 per student per year. So if you have a class that has just 20 students in it, there is north of $500,000 allocated to that classroom and those children. And even if you figure with salary and benefits and, you know, golden parachute pensions and, you know, healthcare and everything else, the teacher costs you $150,000, then you still mm-hmm. have to wonder, where's the other $350,000 going to? Don't blame the disabled kids. They're at most 15% of the population, and they usually cost about 15% more. When you do the math, you can't blame the disabled kids. And so what do you blame it on when you're spending $500,000 per 20-student classroom and you're not getting the job done?
Well, you blame it on those district superintendents, like the Seattle superintendent, who has built himself a little fiefdom there of thousands of people working in the central office and never seeing a student. That's what's happening here in public education.
Can I ask you a quick question? You may know this. I know it for Portland. I don't know it for Seattle. Portland Public Schools have 8,700 employees. And I love asking, you know, people when we get in a conversation about this, how many of the 8,700 in a school district are actually certified teachers? And they'll say, well, it must be like 6,000 or 7,000, right? And they say, nope, less than half. Less than half the employees. And they say, well, they have to have some janitors. I said, janitors does not explain 4,700 employees who do something, but they don't teach kids. And then of the 3,900 that are certified teachers, not all of them actually teach any classes. And
that's
you say,
right.
well,
that's
so you have
right.
an enterprise in which a third of the people in a school district teach and the other two thirds do something else?
Yes, that's the problem here. It's just, it's a government run system. What do you want? It's going to be terribly inefficient.
Private.
It's going to be it's self-interested in growing its budget. And how does it do that? It hires more people than it needs. I mean, essentially what's happening here, and it's become a huge burden on the taxpayers of Washington State and Oregon, because what can be done in a one-party state? There's no way to hold them accountable. And what's going to happen now in Seattle is the superintendent who's paid very well to balance the budget doesn't balance the budget and runs down to his friends in the state house and says, I need a $100 million bailout. So that's the next step. That's what we'll see next.
Yeah, $100 million. And this guy, this Joker Jones, makes a third of $1 million a year in salary to make decisions that he's clearly not capable of making. And he gets benefits and pension on top of that. One third of $1 million to Superintendent Jones, and he can't make a decision to save his life.
If you're
Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Google. Yeah, he's everywhere. The Lars Larson Podcast.
Our climate crisis is not a partisan issue. And it is not a hoax.
Yes, it is.
It is an existential threat to all of us, particularly poor communities and communities of color who bear the greatest risks from polluted air, polluted water, and a failing infrastructure.
That, of course, is cackling Kamala Harris, the Democrats' nominee without a single American voter involved in it at all, for president of the United States. And she's talking about climate crisis. Oh, they all want to tell you it's settled science. Forget about it. It's already settled science. I'm sure at one point in human history, scientists were told, of course, the universe revolves around the Earth. The Earth does not revolve around the sun. Why, that's settled science. And we get the same kind of nonsense now. I would figure that any time a scientist or somebody who claims to be a scientist is telling me why we've settled this, we absolutely know there is no such thing as man power or powered flight by man. Yeah, the Wright brothers were told that over and over again. We were told you can't fly to the moon. We were told all kinds of things you can do. Well, guess what? Some of the chickens are coming home to roost on all this. 5 days ago, the Washington Post published a story that basically takes most of the climate nonsense and simply reverses it. And I point out that it was the Washington Post that published it. They based it on a story or a study that was published in the journal Science, which is, you know, I'm not a scientist, but it's one of the most well-respected scientific journals literally on planet Earth. Let me get into the details of that in just a moment, because it's going to blow your mind. We are now at the coolest point for Earth in the last 450 million years, according to that study published in Science, and then the story about it published in the Washington Post about 5 days ago. First, though, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we'll be going to put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you take a moment, vote in our X poll. You'll find a brand new question every single day at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll also find the question on our website at LarsLarson.com. But first, let me tell you about this, because this is groundbreaking. Ordinarily, if you turn on local news, you're going to hear about every single study out there that says that the climate crisis is real. There was a time when they called it global warming. And then, you know, for whatever reason, the Earth just stubbornly refused to warm the way that the computer models had predicted. So they had to drop global warming and start calling it the climate crisis or climate science. And why do they do that? Because that means no matter what happens, if it gets colder, it's because of climate change. If it gets warmer, it's because of climate change. If it gets wetter, if it gets drier, if the pressure goes up, if the pressure goes down, no matter what the change is, it's all just about climate. And it doesn't make any sense. I mean, scientifically, it makes no sense at all. So what is pointed out? The Washington Post published this story 5 days ago. And what they said was they were reporting on an ambitious effort to understand the Earth's climate over the last 485 million years that has revealed a history of wild shifts and far hotter temperatures than scientists previously realized. Well, I think to some extent the scientists didn't want to realize that, because they said we can't very well tell people that we're in the middle of this irreversible global warming caused by the most evil thing on Earth, which is human beings and all of their activities. If we tell them it's been warmer before and it got better, it's been cooler before, and we are now at the coolest point in about 450 million years, then it kind of blows a hole in the middle of all this climate nonsense. The story was cited in a recent study in the journal Science that said the world was a much warmer place for most of the history of complex animal life. So we're not talking about going back to when the Earth was a big ball of volcanoes and gas and hot stuff. The story says At its hottest, the study suggests the Earth's average temperature reached 96.8, not 98.6, that would be human beings, 96.8 degrees Fahrenheit, far higher than the historic 58.96 that the planet hit last year. Now, do you remember when all the local news stations and the big national media were saying, why, the Earth has hit its hottest point ever at 58.96, about 40 degrees cooler than where the Earth's average temperature was, according to this study. The chart from the Washington Post shows the closest time period when the global temperature has been this low, according to the published study in Journal in Science, was about 350 million years ago. We are now at a very cold point in the Earth's history, and that ought to be a concern. Because if you think the Earth is getting hotter, it gives politicians an excuse to say, we have to stop burning coal. We have to stop burning oil. We have to stop burning natural gas. We can't have more nuclear. All we can have is solar panels and windmills. Now, if all of a sudden you find out we're actually at a very, very cold point over the last 350 million years, a third of a billion years, and now it's either getting colder or it might get a little bit warmer, but we've been here before and the planet did just fine, and the historic average of 58.96, almost 59 degrees, call it, rounded up to 59 degrees. They say that's been the average, and we hit this, and it was the highest point we've ever been. And then it turns out that the scientific journal Science says, no, we were actually at an average of 96.8 for a long, long time. So consider that and ask your local meteorologist, especially if they're the kind of local weatherman who likes to talk about climate change all the time. Ask him if he's read that study and what he makes of it and how does it fit with the claptrap that he's been shoveling out for the last few years. Let's go to Chris. Hey, Chris, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, I just had a couple of comments about the school stuff. My older sister has just retired from the Riverside School District after 44 years. She was credentialed, but she was what she called an educator. She spent most of her time in the administrative end, building curriculums and things like that. And then she taught older people, the seniors and non-graduated people with GEDs at night, during night school. I don't know if they even do that stuff anymore.
Which
she told me that when she recently left, she said that it was a 3-to-1 or 4-to-1 average, a teacher in the classroom versus administrators. And that's where the glut of the budget comes from.
I agree.
The administration part of the school. Part two, my grandson occasionally rides the bus home from school. The bus literally will stop within a 100-yard span 6 to 7 times to let an individual out of the school bus. Instead of stopping at the end of the street, Lars, my street might be 60 yards long. That's it. And the fleet of school buses these schools have is unbelievable.
Sounds like door-to-door service all day long, which is very nice and also very expensive, but it employs a lot of public employees or private contractors working for government. Thanks for the call. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Political climate. He's the steamroller. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. If I told you that hundreds of millions of your tax dollars are going to fund the Chinese military, you'd probably say, Lars, you're full of baloney. It couldn't be happening. I mean, not under the Biden administration. I mean, we know that Joe Biden and his family have been so antithetical to anything China wants to do. Why in the world would they do something like that? So I thought we'd ask Keith Hansen, who's CEO of QUX Technologies, veteran law enforcement expert. Keith, welcome back to the program.
Great to be back with you. Thanks so much for having me today.
So we not only funded their dangerous virus research in Wuhan, but we're also funding their military. Is there anything the Biden administration won't do?
Well, we've been funding China for how long now? How long have we been seeing products that say made in China? And of course, when you're talking about a communist, and people, I love how the left is very quick to come out and say, well, they're a capitalist state because look at how many millionaires and billionaires they produce. Well, it's called state sponsored capitalism.
Yep.
It's basically fascism. That yes, there are people who are at least on the surface involved in private financial ventures, but they are always in bed with the government. Just here in the United States, we call that the public-private partnership. But it's the same thing. It's that the government is propping something up. It's giving it dollars. And this is the thing. This is certainly part of the illusion that creates this narrative that you see, especially coming out of the left here in this country, that, well, China's really not that bad, and that this is this softer, more gentler form of socialism. So it's not communism, because true communism has never been achieved. It's all just varying degrees of destructive and lethal socialism, and that's exactly what we're seeing here. But no, to answer your question more directly, we are absolutely propping up China's military. We're propping up the Chinese government. We're sending billions, if not trillions, of dollars over to China. And I think people don't understand right now that there is a war going on with China to control what are called rare earth elements and critical minerals. And rare earth elements are those 17 different types of elements that I think most people, when I say elements, I'm talking about, yes, they actually appear on the periodic table.
You mean like germanium and technetium and
germanium,
a whole bunch
of other... scandium and dysprosium and yttrium and all of these different ums. And these ums, all of these different elements, are literally being fueled or being used to fuel a new technological revolution in this country. And so these critical minerals and rare earth elements, these are materials that are being relied heavily upon for very, very experimental research and development. And then the build out of technology in aerospace, in energy, in defense, and in aerospace, energy, defense, energy being
medicine,
one of the biggest ones.
Yeah.
And so it does boil down to a national security issue. China controls 90% of these REEs, but what a lot of people don't realize is that, first of all, who controls the rare earth elements controls the next wave in the evolution of technology. And so that is something that can be used. Rhodium, as a matter of fact, rhodium is something that China has just recently put a moratorium on the export of. The intellectual property and the extraction technology to be able to mine or to extract from waste material from mines, the rare earth elements, these are things that China are restricting very, very heavily.
So in other words, they steal our technology, Keith, and then when they come up with something cool and neat that it can actually pull this stuff out, they say, but we're not letting this go to you guys. So they get the benefit of not only the stuff they develop.
Not only that, but they're also in this country buying up mineral rights and literally shipping. So you think about all those ocean-going containers that come to the United States and to Canada and to Mexico. Okay? And so all of those contain Chinese goods. So under normal circumstances, what would happen? Are we exporting things back to China? No. So those containers, they would deadhead. They would go back to China empty. But now China is filling those with dirt, literally with dirt. And they are shipping dirt back to China because they have the technology to be able to, on an atomic level, extract these rare earth elements from that dirt. And this isn't just, any dirt. They're not out there, just digging holes in the ground randomly. They are selecting specific areas that are rich or dense in these REEs, and they are buying mineral rights, and they are shipping containers, transports, full of dirt back to China because now they can extract, obtain those rare earth elements, and as of right now, China controls 90% of the rare earth element market.
And by the way, Keith, over the last several years, we've had people on to talk about this. We have a lot of these, maybe not all of them, but we have them here, except they're effectively locked up by the controls, both environmental rules and other rules. I mean, there was just a big lithium fine in the northern end of Nevada. And yet the conclusion after having found it was, yeah, it's there. It's one of the richest, closest to the surface deposits we've found, but we probably won't be able to mine it because we've made rules that forbid us. We have made rules that forbid us from actually mining it. And that's true of a lot of the other REs that are present in the United States, but we can't pull them out of our own ground because of our own rules.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
And there are some creative ways. I mean, our company, QX Technologies, we are heavily invested in REE infrastructure and extraction projects. And a lot of those are actually remediation projects, where the projects that we're getting involved in now, we're actually getting the blessing and the green light from various state departments of environmental protection because we're actually doing cleanup initiatives. When you use the word mining, that's a four-letter word. And you know, even in internal documents, we would never use the word mining because that's not what we're doing. Mining implies that we're taking pristine land and we're putting, you know, scars and big holes in it, and it's not pretty and nobody likes it, and it kills the ruby-throated sparrows and everything else. That's not what we're looking at. We're looking at taking existing waste material from mines and extracting rare earth elements from that. But no, what you're describing is very similar. That people probably recognize that as being the central theme of the Drill Baby Drill campaign,
yep.
Where we have vast oil and natural gas resources here, oil, shale, everything else. But there are moratoriums on being able to obtain those, so now we are dependent on countries that are hostile to the United States for our energy needs, when we should just focus on being self-sufficient and self-reliant.
I agree. Keith, in the 1 minute I've got left, I want to ask you one quick question. Mm-hmm. Should the United States government, as a matter of national security, forbid the shipment of these boxes of dirt back to China?
Of course. Absolutely. Because every container load of dirt that goes back to China is another gram or kilogram or ton of rare earth element that they control that our innovators don't have access to. And again, all of these materials are responsible for research and development and advances in technology in energy. Major. The reason why green energy doesn't work isn't because the green energy doesn't do a good job of generating power. It's the batteries to store the energy. And so the research and development that's going into effective means of storing energy that's generated through wind and solar, that's critical right now. The aerospace industry, the technology, and the defense sectors, they are all dependent upon REEs. So to put this another way, it's dependent upon material, 90% of which is being controlled by the greatest existential threat to this country.
Absolutely. That's Keith Hansen, CEO of QUX Technologies, veteran law enforcement expert, but technology guy as well. Back in a moment. We'll get to your phone calls and emails. Naysayers go to the head of the line on the Lars Larson Show.
Words from President Reagan.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us. We the people are the driver. The government is the car. And we decide where it should go.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. This segment of the show always brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialist, Oregon Medical Centers. And today's X-Poll, and this question, it has to do specifically with some recent actions by the Seattle Public Schools, but it could easily apply to lots of school districts. Should school districts close their empty buildings and use the resources to educate the kids, or keep them open, empty buildings, just to make the neighborhoods happy? I think you know which one I would choose. Close the empty real estate, or hand it over to the charter schools, or rent it to private schools. For goodness sake, it's not taxed because it's owned by the government. It's an owned asset in most cases. They don't owe a dime on it. So it's billions of dollars of property that's sitting there unused and costing the taxpayers money every single day and not benefiting the kids. So I would say close the empty buildings. You can find today's X-Bowl at Lars Larson Show, and it's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go to naysayer John. Hey, John, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
Well, I think you're giving out some erroneous information regarding climate change. And it's this. You're thinking too small on the whole problem, because there are certain things about climate change that cannot account for these massive ice ages, where you can have in 1-2 years a mile of ice build up in the northern hemisphere. And there's some exciting research that I haven't seen much more online about it, but they're finding, you know, interstellar space is not uniform, but it has particle densities. And they're finding that it's when the solar system moves into an interstellar space area that has a higher particle density, it can explain away how these huge ice ages develop, because and when they adjust the climate change model to include the nature of interstellar space.
Okay, but hold on a second, John. You said I put out bad information. I never want to put out bad info. What was the bad information that I provided?
Well, it's just erroneous. You make it sound like it's based on the solar system, and I'm saying it goes beyond that. So you're thinking too small is what I think the erroneous information is.
Okay, fair enough. I take the point. Let's go to a second naysayer, and that's Susan. Susan, welcome, and thanks for the call from Bellingham, and thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
And thanks for taking my call. I'm a former teacher, and one of the things that I know makes a difference with kids to have them succeed is having small class sizes. And every time I brought it up to folks, they say, well, you know, we don't have the infrastructure for that. So it makes me a little crazy to hear that they're empty school buildings. If we really wanted to put our money where our mouth is, we really want to educate these kids, drop the class sizes. We know better.
Okay, but Susan, can I ask you something? Having the empty classrooms is the first part, but you would agree with me. The second part is you got to put a teacher in it. And I've also read a bunch, and tell me if you disagree, because I don't want to put out bad information. All the academic studies I've read say that if you change class size from, I think the current average in the Northwest is about 23 or 24. And of course, we hear horror stories of certain classes that are 40, but 23 or 24 is the average. If you move that from 23 to 21 or to 20, it makes almost no difference at all. If you can move to a, you know, like private school small classes where you've got a dozen kids and one teacher, that actually makes a big difference. But moving it by, you know, one or two or three usually makes almost no difference at all. And that's not me. That's the academic studies done of teachers by teachers, usually by universities. If you just have a bunch of empty buildings and you could close some of them and have more resources, which means dollars, and in Seattle Public Schools, for example, 83% of their budget goes to salaries. So you could have more teachers in classrooms and still have fewer empty buildings, because by having fewer empty buildings, you don't have the cost of maintaining a bunch of empty space. You'd have more money to hire teachers and reduce the class sizes. You could also do this. Susan, I don't know what the split is in Bellingham. Do you know how many people the Bellingham schools employ in total?
Lars, all I know is I will congratulate you on being right about the class size. In my opinion, class sizes should never, and I thought it was the law here in Washington State, but hey, what do I know? They should never go above 18. 16.
I don't think that's true, though.
Below for class sizes. And
Susan,
then, oh, hold on, could I just,
okay,
I know you're short on time.
Go ahead.
Okay. The thing is that what they're doing is they're giving teachers stipends. So when you talk about getting pay increases, stipends don't help me teach any better. If I have 24 kids, it does not matter.
Nope, I get
that. I need low class sizes.
But let me ask you a question, Susan. Portland Public Schools have 8,700 employees. I know the numbers well. They have 3,900 teachers. Fewer than half the people on the payroll are actually teaching a class. And of the certified teachers, not all of them are actually teaching kids. They're doing other assignments. If you took the Bellingham schools and you took it down to a ratio where you have a very small number of administrative people and the majority of your employees were teachers because you're running a school, would that make a difference right now?
If you could make the class sizes small, it would make a huge difference.
If you hire more teachers, don't you automatically...
My kids are succeeding.
Okay. If you hire more teachers instead of administrators and they actually go to a classroom and teach, you automatically get smaller class sizes just like that. But you got to fire a whole bunch of paper-pushing bureaucrats. The Lars